commandments. We're at number 9. And up until now, the commandments have prohibited actions. Today it's words, next week it's going to be thoughts. Now, people love top tens, don't they? And the commandments, for want of a better expression, are pretty much like a top ten. So for me, the obvious question is, why has God included this in the top ten? And the reason is really simple. God wants his people to be truthful. And this is massively relevant to us today. We're immersed in a culture where lying is part of everyday life. All too often, it's like water off a duck's back. It's par for the course. Sure, some lies incur a frown of disapproval. They just are considered that step too far. And perjury is an example of that, which we're going to come on to. But on the whole, lying is seen as just one of those things. It's not approved of, but hey, it happens. Just get on with it. Deal with it. A recent survey revealed this. 40% of people lie on their CV. 60% of adults can't have a 10-minute conversation without lying. 86% of children regularly lie to their parents. And a staggering 90% of people on dating websites lie in their profile. Now, you might say to me, Jace, you know what? I'm not on a dating website, and my spouse, well, she knows I'm 16 stone, and I'm not a pilot. But don't think that Christians aren't immune. 51% of Christians surveyed admitted to having told a lie in the past month. Lying is something that affects every one of us, me included. None of us had to be taught to lie. It was in our DNA. It came as naturally to us as breathing. And the reality is, for most of us, we've just got better the older we've got. God's words on this topic could not be more relevant. And so we're going to look at this topic today under 5 C's. And the first is this, the context. How does it fit? Remember what Johnny said towards the beginning of the series. It's all about location, location, location. God has already rescued the Israelites from Egypt. This is not about them saving themselves by complying with the rules. God saved them because he was gracious. They didn't deserve it, they didn't earn it, and they couldn't have done it for themselves. Only God could do it, and he did it out of his love for them. And now he wants the people that he saved to be his witnesses to the nations around them. And he wants his people to reflect his glory. And if you're like me, a Christian here today, then you and me, we are modern day Israelites. We've been saved by God's grace, and these commandments are primarily directed to us, Christians, not the world around us. And they're there so we can be a witness to what's around us, who's around us, and so that we can reflect his glory. Not living our lives according to the culture, but living it God's way. And this whole area of the 9th commandment is an area in which we can not only be deliciously different, but radically different. So that's the context. What about the second C, the command? What does the command say? You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. This command primarily relates to false testimony in court, perjury. Just a few chapters later, we're going to see this again. Grab your Bibles and have a look at Exodus 23, which is on page 81. Exodus 23, verses 1 to 3. Do not spread false reports. Do not help a guilty person by being a malicious witness. Do not follow the crowd in doing wrong. When you give testimony in a lawsuit, do not pervert justice by siding with the crowd, and do not show favoritism to a poor person in a lawsuit. Now, I can tell you, because of my job, that perjury is viewed incredibly seriously in this country. If somebody's guilty of perjury, they go to prison, period. And any offence which involves perverting the course of justice is a go-straight-to-jail offence, and you do not pass go. And that's absolutely right. And I suspect everyone in this room would agree with that. To find yourself in the dock, facing prison, the possibility of being torn from your family, missing your kids growing up, losing your job and your reputation for something you didn't do, would be horrendous. Imagine there, standing in the public gallery, as your loved one is in the dock, and the jury walk back into court, and as the foreperson stands up and they're asked, have you reached a verdict, guilty or not guilty? And the foreperson says, guilty. All because somebody has made a false allegation. Imagine the horror in that verdict for your loved one and for you as a family. I had it once. A case where I'm absolutely convinced the man didn't do it. One case in 20 years of practice, charged with a serious sexual offence on his niece. There were many worrying aspects to the evidence, and yet the jury convicted. As they pronounced their verdict, my client put his head down and said quietly, with not a trace of anger in his voice, God forgive you for what you've done. The press reported it as God forgive me for what I've done. But somebody read the newspaper article that quote was in. And they came forward. And they came forward and they said, you know what? I don't know that defendant. But I remember a teenage girl coming up to me and saying that she was going to stitch her uncle up because she wanted a pony. And when I read that article, I put two and two together, and I'm coming forward now. He thought it had just been teenage talk, so he'd ignored it at the time. So we appealed. The prosecutor, now a judge, came to me outside the courtroom and said, Jace, I really hope you win this appeal. I've been worried about this conviction ever since it happened. But after a full day's argument in the Court of Appeal, they took the view that even though this witness who had come forward was credible, they were not going to interfere with the conviction, because that's not something that the Court of Appeal does lightly. And when that man was released, after serving a 6-year prison sentence, he came into chambers one day while I was at court. And he said to my clerk, I know Jason can't help me anymore, but I've served this sentence for a crime I did not do. I am not angry. I am not seeking revenge. But I didn't do it, and I want to clear my name. Is there any way Jason can point me in a direction where I can do it? He never did. He still stands convicted to this day. And I am rubbish at names. Absolutely rubbish. But I still remember his. And that was 15 years ago. Perjury is serious. We get that. And it's no surprise that we get it, because we're made in God's image. The image is distorted, but traces still remain. And the dual threads of justice and truth that run all through the Bible resonate with us. And that's why miscarriages of justice trouble us. And they trouble God too. Grab your Bibles again and have a look at Deuteronomy. And this is Deuteronomy chapter 19. And you'll find it on page 197. Because we're going to hear now God's punishment for perjury. And it's much worse than prison. So, page 197, 19 verse 5. One witness is not enough to convict anyone accused of any crime or offence they may have committed. A matter must be established by the testimony of two or three witnesses. If a malicious witness takes the stand to accuse someone of a crime, the two people involved in the dispute must stand in the presence of the Lord before the priests and the judges who were in office at the time. The judges must make a thorough investigation. And if the witness proves to be a liar, giving false testimony against a fellow Israelite, then do to the false witness as that witness intended to do to the other party. You must purge the evil from among you. The rest of the people will hear of this and be afraid, and never again will such an evil thing be done among you. Show no pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. That's one of the passages that people get an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth from. And that pretty much sums up what God is saying should be done to a dishonest witness. If their testimony had been believed and the person had gone to prison, then the perjurer should go to prison. But if their testimony had been believed and the person would have been put to death, then they should be put to death. Now, this wasn't God going over the top. A deliberately willful and calculated decision to lie against a member of God's family would damage, disunify, and destroy the community that God had rescued. Why? To reflect his glory. Now, you might be sat there, and you might be thinking, well, Jace, this is a bit like the internet dating thing again. I'm not going to commit perjury. Well, I really hope you don't. But can I just say, again, from my experience of my day job, don't think that anything is beyond you. Not only have I represented people who never, ever expected to be in the dock, I've represented Christians who never expected to be in the dock. One simple lie, often in a moment of panic, whether it's being caught for speeding. And if you lose your license, you'll lose your job. And if you lose your job, then you'll lose your house because you can't pay the mortgage. And if you lose your house, then the kids have to move school. And yet your partner has no points on their license. It's a victimless crime, isn't it? It's not. What about an exaggerated insurance claim? You've paid your premiums for years. You know full well the insurance company you're going to hammer down your claim because that's what insurance companies do. You don't mind them taking the excess because you signed up for the excess, but actually hammering you down for a television which you're going to have to pay for £1,000 and then now saying it's only worth £500, that's not really on. So you slightly overdo your claim. So you're not trying to make a profit, you're trying to have a level playing field. You don't think the claim's ever going to be challenged, but then it is. And then you find yourself between a rock and a hard place. Do you own up and expose the lie in the first place? Or do you keep going down the track? If any of you have ever mountain biked, and you're on a bike and you're in a furrow in the ground, and you're going faster and faster and faster, the only way you can get out is to stop and get out. And the problem is, lies need other lies to survive. They don't have legs on their own. They rarely exist in isolation. Very few people set out to make malicious and fabricated claims. It's often either foolish, impulsive, panic, or greed. But it sets many people off on a path of no return. And Christians are just as much at risk of those errors of judgment as other people. Do not bear false testimony, or you risk putting yourself in the position where you feel that you have no option but to continue lying. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. But to limit this commandment to false testimony in court would be to interpret it far too narrowly. As I said at the outset, it relates to the importance of telling truth generally. Did you notice from our reading, one of the readings in Proverbs chapter 6, that the Lord doesn't just hate a false witness, he also detests a lying tongue. And when you stop and think about the subtle ways in which we can tell lies, then this commandment suddenly becomes a lot more real than the remote, or what we think is a remote, and I hope it is, possibility of perjury. Flattery. So easy to do without really meaning it, especially when it may benefit you. What's the harm? It makes the person feel good and you're just being nice. But if it's not true, or you don't mean it. David said in the Psalms, with flattering lips and a double heart they speak, may the Lord cut off all flattering lips. Exaggerating. That's lying. Often to make us or our kids look good. Gossip. Saying something, not knowing or caring whether it's true. Especially dangerous in a digital world when at the touch of a button, something could be circulated to a captive audience of hundreds, possibly thousands, if it's shared when you no longer have any control over it. What were the first words of that passage in Exodus 23 that we read? Don't spread false reports. The ripple effect of gossip can be incalculable. slander, speaking deliberate untruths of people which tear down rather than build up. In Leviticus, very clear, chapter 19, verse 6, don't go about spreading slander. That's what we're commanded. And on this point, what message do we send to our kids if they see us buying and reading tabloids or publications that thrive on salacious rumor? Cheating on your homework or your tax return. Insinuating, not actually saying the lie, but implying it. Silence, lying by omission. Hearing something that you either know or suspect is untrue. Just stay quiet, though. Possibly out of selfish ambition or petty revenge. Just going around this week whilst preparing the sermon, when obviously some things are more at the forefront of your mind, brought home to me how easy it is to lie or mislead. And you know what the biggest danger area for me was? When I didn't want to cause offence or hurt somebody. So, for example, Tuesday, I was invited out for lunch. There were a number of reasons why I might not want to go, but the real reason was I didn't want to go. I didn't want to go to lunch with that person. And so rather than thinking, you know what, I've got to have the guts to come out and say this, I start thinking to myself, okay, what excuses can I give? Or maybe I can do it this way. This is quite clever. I'll say that I'll go, but I'll say that something might crop up at the last minute, which it could have, which might mean I'm not able to go. Do you remember that statistic for Christians, 51%? Guess what the reason was for that 51% having lied? To avoid hurting someone. We're called to speak truth, but in love. And if we're taking the ninth commandment seriously, we need to be people of integrity in all situations, even awkward ones. We do it sensitively, but we do it honestly. The essence of a lie is more than the words themselves. It's deception. Jesus hates any intention to mislead. He hates exaggerated impressions. He hates it when the truth is suppressed. He hates facts being twisted to mislead, insinuate, or give false impressions. And he hates any intention to ruin someone else's reputation with untruth. In contrast, he loves it when we tell the truth, when we're transparent, when we refuse to join in or spread gossip or tittle-tattle because we don't know whether it's accurate. In a nutshell, he loves it when we're completely straight. Proverbs chapter 2 tells us this. God is a shield to those who walk in integrity, guarding the paths of justice and watching over the way of his saints. And you know what? Integrity is built by defeating the temptation to be dishonest. So now, the third C, the cause. Why do we lie? What tempts us? What tempts you to be dishonest? Well, on a human level, there can be any one of a number of reasons. But it's good to try and work them out, because that will help us to be on guard when those situations present themselves. And it seems to me, and this is not exhaustive, but there are common examples. Number one, to avoid trouble. And I think this is a biggie, and it's a biggie with kids especially, but it doesn't change when you get older. So often, when we think we might be in trouble, lying is an instinctive reaction. It can be spontaneous, as with Peter, the first time he denied knowing Jesus, or it can be planned, like Joseph's brothers claiming that he'd been killed by a wild animal. But either way, fear of consequences and our natural desire to protect ourselves is a deadly combination. The next time your self-protection radar pings and you think, oh, I could be in trouble here, be on guard. Alarm bells should be ringing. The temptation to lie will not be far behind. What other examples are there? To gain an advantage, whether that's in a friendship group, job applications, the workplace, wherever. To make money, to make yourself more liked, to get attention, to impress people, to get revenge, or even for convenience, Have you cleaned your room? I can't be bothered. Yeah! Or one for the adults. Do I look big in this? Ooh, I'm going to get into trouble with that. Speak the truth, but really do that one in love. But also to avoid embarrassment. What about when you've had a bad week? You've had a row with your kids, you've had a row with your wife. And somebody says, how's your week been? What do we say? Is that truthful? You know, the only exception that I could find in the Bible to lying was when it was to save life. Rahab lied to save the spies. Jonathan lied to protect David. The midwives in Egypt lied so that Moses wasn't killed. Avoiding embarrassment doesn't come on the list. We need to speak truth in love. Maybe that involves saying, you know what, it's not been a great week, but I'd rather not go into reasons if that's all right. Remember, integrity is built by defeating the temptation to be dishonest. So in any one of those scenarios, and I'm sure you can think of more, be alert. You and me, we are prime candidates of being at risk of flirting with untruthfulness. But that's the human side to it. And ultimately, all that surface dressing. Because the root of the problem is not the situation that you find yourself in. That just gives you a platform to lie. The root of the problem is in there. It's the heart. In Jeremiah we read, the heart is deceitful above all things. And Jesus said, but the things that come out of a person's mouth come from where? The heart. And these defile them. For out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, slander. This is so fundamental. It's absolutely key to properly understanding this and every other commandment. If we try to stop lying in our own strength, we'll fail. Because willpower can't change what's inside. And we're going to look at that more closely when we come to the last C. But before we get to that, the fourth C. The consequence. Why does truthfulness matter? Three things. First, because the devil is the father of all lies. Grab your Bibles and have a look at John chapter 8, page 1074. John chapter 8, verse 44. Jesus speaking to the Jews. That's the context. You belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. Keep your finger in that passage. But our language is English. The devil's language is lie. His whole character, everything he is, stands for, revolves around, is lies. You literally cannot believe a single word he says. That's why the Bible consistently refers to him as the deceiver. And that's exactly what he did with Eve in the Garden of Eden. If you eat from this, you'll surely live. She didn't. That signed her death warrant. And the devil knew it when he said it. When you lie as a Christian, you're speaking the devil's language. And I find that really, really sobering. All the devil wanted to do was drag me down to hell with him. So Christ willingly died for me to rescue me from his death grip. And yet every now and again, when it suits me, I'll speak his language rather than that of my father. I should want nothing more to do with him. I should be fleeing anything that's associated with the devil. I wouldn't dream of using a Ouija board. But sadly, I might not think twice about telling a lie, especially white ones or ones that spare hurt. But the Bible tells us, Proverbs 12, lying lips are an abomination to the Lord. But when we look at God, what a contrast. Turn back to John and look at the first five words of verse 45. Yet, put because in brackets, I, this is Jesus speaking, tell the truth. God always speaks the truth. We read in Hebrews that it's impossible, impossible for God to lie. It goes against his very nature, everything about him, everything he stands for. Just pause for a minute and picture in your mind's eye one of the things that you hate the most. Okay? So much that it repulses you, it upsets you, it breaks your heart. And your stance on this issue is so well known to the people that know you because it's so, so important to you. Now, take the person closest to you, the one who claims they love you more than anything or anyone else. And obviously, they know this thing about you too. Now imagine that loved one regularly doing the thing that repulses you the most. And not just when they're on their own, but when they're with you, in your presence, right in front of you, either not thinking about how it makes you feel or not really caring. We are called to imitate, as Christians, our Father. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 1. Follow God's example, therefore. Why? As dearly loved children. Our Father is not, if we are Christians, the devil. It's God. And it's his example we should be following. And ultimately, that's why lying matters. Parents, think how you would feel for a moment if the child that you brought into the world, the child that you cared for, nurtured, and tried to lead by example, chose instead to emulate character traits of the worst role model that you could possibly think of instead of emulating you. Apart from your own hurt, add to that then how you would feel if your friends, family, or work colleagues started looking at the child and thinking, well, if that's how the child is behaving, then that, therefore, is how the parents must have brought them up. Our lies hurt God, and our lies reflect on God. That's why truthfulness gets in the top 10, and that's why lying gets a double mention in the top 7. And I haven't even touched on the hurt, the human hurt, that flows from false testimony or lies generally. In your own time, look at what happened to Joseph after the false allegation by Potiphar's wife. Trace the fallout of David's dishonesty over his affair with Bathsheba. It's no surprise that we read later in Ephesians, therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth to his neighbor, for we are members of one another. We are God's family. We carry the family name. We should care for the impact of lies on the family, and not just on the effect within, but on the effect without. So the fifth and final C, the cure. How can we be different, deliciously different? Well, the first thing we do is we look to Jesus. He is the way, the truth, and the life. Jesus is the example par excellence of a life of truth, justice, and integrity. You want to see how to speak truth in love? Read the Gospels. You want to see what integrity in the real world looks like? Read the Gospels. I give you a promise today. Spend time with Jesus, and I guarantee you will change. And it'll be from the inside out. And if you aren't sure where to start, can I just tell you something that I found massively helpful? Look at the Gospels. Use Millie's hairband because it's fallen apart. J.C. Ryle's commentaries on the Gospels. You can get them free online now. It's amazing to think somebody who wrote in the 19th century can write things which are so relevant today. Language is a bit oldie-worldy, but they are fantastic. J.C. Ryle on the Gospels. So the first thing, you look at Jesus. Second, we need to confess. If you're anything like me, you will have skirted around the edges of honesty. Either by being clever or cute with words, so technically you haven't lied, even though your intention was to mislead. Or alternatively, you may have blatantly lied for whatever reason. Maybe you didn't want to hurt somebody, or maybe you were ashamed to own up to what you'd done. I've done that too. It's absolutely right that we confess the ugliness of our sin. We're God's children, but we've been speaking the devil's language. But the wonderful thing is, when we do that, there's forgiveness. And we don't come away discouraged. Turn for the last time now to page 1208, which is Hebrews chapter 10. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 19. Therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened up for us through the curtain, that is his body, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart, and with the full assurance that faith brings, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience, and having our bodies washed with pure water. We can have full assurance of faith. Why? Because our hearts have been sprinkled clean. That's the key to the whole of the Ten Commandments. We are so hardwired to try and earn favor with God by doing stuff, by complying with the rules, to impress him, that actually we need to continually remind ourselves that that's not right. That's a fundamental misunderstanding of the Bible. I can't emphasize that enough. If you're not in a personal relationship with God today, don't go away thinking, if I tell the truth, God will be happy with me. Please do tell the truth. But don't think that when you get to heaven's door, you'll be able to say, let me in because I told the truth. Remember the context, location, location, location. The rules come after the Israelites were rescued. You need to be rescued first. And one of the main purposes of the rules, if you look at it that way, is to show us we can't keep them. We can't keep one, let alone 10. So we need to look for the answer elsewhere. And we find that in the gospel, in Jesus. That's where you need, if you're not in a relationship, to focus your intention this morning. And it's where Christians need to refocus their attention. Because Jesus lived the perfect life, that truthful life, so that people like you and me, who've lived imperfect ones, by faith, can have our hearts sprinkled clean and therefore have confidence to boldly come. Imagine that, boldly going into God's presence and saying, you know what? Don't look at my life. Look at his. Thirdly, having already been rescued, we need to put off our old self and put on our new self. As Christians, we're new creations. The old has gone, the new has come. So from the passage that Johnny read to us before in Colossians, do not lie to one another, seeing that you've put off the old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. So how practically can we help ourselves not to lie? Well, with the caveat that it all comes from looking to Jesus and it's from the inside out, there are good habits that we can cultivate, and I'm just going to give three. Spend time with truthful people. David said in the Psalms, I do not sit with men of falsehood. And in Corinthians we read, bad company ruins good morals. Spend time with truthful people. Second, think before you speak. I need this. In James, we're told that every person should be quick to hear, but slow to speak. Maybe have a little checklist about whatever you're about to say. Is it true? Is it fair? Is it necessary? Is it true? Is it fair? Is it necessary? That's really helpful with gossip and flattery. And thirdly and finally, mean what you say. Jesus said, let your yes be yes and your no be no. In other words, be a man or woman of your word. From the smallest things to the biggest things, you don't have levels of honesty. There's no need for, I swear on my mother's life. That's not appropriate for a Christian. That's very, very clear in the same passage that Jesus said, let your yes be yes, let your no be no. Your life should be such that people won't need that from you. It should be, well, if Jason has said that, he'll do it. He means it. That's honouring to God. And that comes from a life of living out the ninth commandment. It's a challenge, isn't it? All of the commandments are. But their purpose is to point our attention to the one who rescued us, so that our lives reflect his character and that we're a witness to those who surround us. So as we go out on our way today into this week, let's heed this command and in his strength be truthful. We're going to sing, Give Me One Pure and Holy Passion, to finish our time together.